and Greensboro is the place where my daughter lives. And an extremely interesting place in its own right. And so I formed the plan of visiting there in spring 2009 to teach evidence of internet. And got all the finances lined up, it all seemed square. And over Thanksgiving was advised by the dean, when I stopped in to say hello to him, that this invitation was in jeopardy because of my smoking marijuana. So I just was on the telephone with him in this very interesting unfolding conversation that seems to be taking place. And so I can bring you up to date on that at some point if you're actually interested. In an odd way, it segues right into this representation of Keith Stroop in the marijuana possession charge against him. It's just quite interesting. It's a question of, in a very interesting way, about the role of a law professor. How can I be a law professor and smoke marijuana? Is that something that's consistent? Or am I somehow giving testimony in derogation of the law, not respecting it? Yes.
As long as you're not advocating for smoking marijuana in your class or something like that, I don't think it's an issue. I don't see what it has to do with your ability to teach.
As long as I'm not advocating it in class?
I mean, you could bring it up as an issue.
Yeah?
But maybe the school wouldn't want their professors espousing a certain position on it. Position that is, it goes against the laws.
Would they have the same problem?
Patrick?
Well, as a law professor, you're expected to have opinions about the law. And I would assume that one of your opinions may be that laws against smoking marijuana are not good or irrational or problematic. So if that's true, it might almost be hypocritical for you not to smoke marijuana. And for that reason, I think it would be, it wouldn't be against your image or ideal as a law professor.
Well, the legal category amongst the three that you've described is rational.
Right.
That is, we defer to the legislature with a presumption of rationality. So I guess the statement of your legal position is that if I believe that laws against smoking marijuana are irrational, then I believe they are unconstitutional. How am I then to act? That's the position you're putting. Well, in a delightfully interesting way, this very same question comes up, at least to me it seems the same, in the context of this RIAA matter that's so swiftly unfolding in front of us. The question is, should I teach you not to download copyrighted material? My position, my thought, my intellectual framework for thinking and teaching about the law leads me to the conclusion that the transactional basis for copyright is blown. That's the nature of the digitally networked environment. And so the idea that somehow I should be teaching you to honor this outmoded form, why would I do that to you? Why would I do that to the society? Why do we want, as a society, to teach our children that an outmoded form of copyright should be ingrained into their behavioral habits? Is that a good thing to teach? Am I somehow out of bounds to teach that the transactional basis for copyright is shot, and that if copyright is to survive, it needs to find a new economic form, a new business plan? Yeah?
I was just gonna raise that. Would they object in your internet course if you're going to be teaching, if we should actually be teaching them? You could even be advocating the fact that progressive breaks it, so you know, we shouldn't honour the kind of transactional system. Would that be a reason for denying you the ability to go there, when that's actually far more related to what they're paying you to do, rather than something which is outside of your kind of the, what you do as a law professor, what you do outside of it, seeing where that's integral? Yet that probably, I suspect, wouldn't actually start at the point in there.
Yeah. I mean, there's a conflict. Yes, Andrew.
I'm sorry.
No, please.
I was just going to say, my question is there something to being a law professor that you're supposed to teach respect for the law, as you put it earlier? I mean, is that part of your obligation? I don't know. I'm not a law student here. It strikes me that you're main role as a law professor is to teach what the law is and how to operate within the body of law that exists. But I'm not sure that this concept of respect for the law, whatever that means, is part of your responsibility. That's just really a question to throw back at you.
Oh, that's very interesting. I actually, as you articulated, I define my role more broadly.
Okay.
I think of myself as a professor of Harvard, mm-hmm. and the commitment of the tenure. I mean, what? Why am I tenured?
Sure.
What am I tenured to do?
Sure.
In some sense, I'm tenured to teach Veritas.
Sure.
So the idea that as part of my mission to do that, I see a legal system that is subject to self-interest in ways that produce corruption of the original understanding, mm-hmm. and produce irrational laws which judges nonetheless say we presume their rationality as they trample liberty. Where do I stand on that? As a teacher, I want to be able to take the legal system as my subject and teach it, and not as my constraint.
That's interesting. And there's a long tradition here of civil disobedience, right? I mean, there's a plenty of room for you to argue that you can teach civil disobedience just as well as you can teach adherence to the law while still respecting the law. I think the question is really more focused on the marijuana issue. I mean, if you personally are in violation of some law, then, you know, is it possible to be consistent with your mission? I think that for me is a more pressing question.
Yes.
But again, it's the institution judging particular law. I say if you're well known to have lots of speeding tickets, or yeah, it is that you could say that's, you know, that potentially endangers other people's lives. So you shouldn't ever shouldn't be allowed to far more responsible for smoking marijuana. And so the institution, by singling out marijuana as a particular issue, is then making a value judgment about it, and kind of the same as they would do if they, with the copyright, if they enforce or give a letter, they're taking a position. And you'd think the institution would shy away from doing that because it should shy away from doing that because it's expending capital that maybe it doesn't, it shouldn't have, or it, you know, shouldn't use it in that way. I think that would be a very good reason to wonder what the institution like if they're willing to make a fuss about.
Do you suppose possession of marijuana is considered malum prohibitum, or is it malum in se? It is a misdemeanor, but it's a misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months in prison. Yes?
I mean, ideally, I would think that it's the former rather than the latter. From what I understand, dating back to, you know, prehistory, humans had always used the vegetation around them in various forms, medicinal and otherwise. So I don't see anything inherently wrong in, you know, in some universal sense in the consumption of a particular hallucinogen or other compound. But obviously it is something that is prohibited by law, so it seems to fall in the category of non-prohibited.
So what would you think? Would someone who is committed to law violation malum prohibitum be prohibited from participating in a university community? Well, I don't mean to make this about me. We have some work to do here this afternoon in the form of yes.
Sorry, it's a bit light. I just don't think it's a legal issue. I think it's a political issue. The school just doesn't want to be, perhaps doesn't want to be associated with the issue at all. It's less acceptable in that culture.
That's possible in the marijuana context is a Wysansky motion. Charlie Wysansky was a distinguished graduate of this school of an earlier generation, a very striking gentleman, became a federal district judge and was disgusted with marijuana prosecutions during the basically 60s, 70s. He instituted a rule in his court that prosecutors had to swear an oath that they had not smoked marijuana in order to go forward with a marijuana prosecution. And the prosecutions in Charlie Wozanski's court pretty much stuck. Think that motion has any chance in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Not sure it'll help you too much in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Well, I think it's interesting from a lawyer's point of view what it is I'm looking for. I'm looking for ways to raise the issue that have different consequences to it, because it means that there is a whole different calculus of what it would take to get a yes. You know, this is a kind of a rule that you'd never get an appellate court to impose. But you might just get some maverick trial judge to say, if Charlie was asking to, I'm not going to get in trouble for it. And it would sure be a way of sending a message. So,
I can just plug this into the adapter up there or something. Screen on this. All right, that's fine. All right, so mine, you can ignore this title, this, we're going to be talking about that for now, but so this is my project. My project has to do with professional athletes who have been either accused, alleged, or some sort of thing of crimes, and the kind of public backlash that has surrounded these athletes. So this is the website I created, long and painstaking, to kind of be like as a forum for people to come to and see how it's affected people in the past, and then kind of build on it in the future to have new people in there and have information for people. So kind of just a opening page, get you introduction to what the site is.
What's the URL?
Currently, it's jbeachman.googlepages.com. But one thing that I want to talk about today is one. Part of what I want to do is talk with you guys about is what the kind of the URL should be and what kind of, because right now it's Media Convictions, which is an open URL, but I'm not too high on that name. So I was hoping by the end that we could come up with something that might be a little more catchy, a little bit more useful than mediaconvictions.com. But that's a homepage. So I guess I'll start with just the historical perspective on things. So basically I want to give a couple of examples of how previously, athletes had been treated where they've been given kind of the deference for due process before any sort of backlash has come to them, either by a league or sponsor and those types of things. In 2000, Ray Lewis was charged with the murders of two people after the Super Bowl in 2000. He was charged. Eventually, he plea bargained down. He was only ended up getting a plea bargain for obstruction of justice. It ended up with a fine from the NFL. And then nothing from the Baltimore Ravens. Eventually, he was on the cover of Madden 2005. It also has a bunch of other endorsements, and it's like the head endorser for Under Armour Athletic Wear. So this is kind of a case where we kind of withheld judgment on Ray Lewis until all the facts had come in, and he wasn't really that much of a part of what happened. He was just there and didn't really help out the police in their investigation, and didn't really see all the consequences that we see today in some of the athletes who get in trouble in the media. Another case in the past is Brett Myers, who was a pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies. This is just last year. In 2006, he was seen hitting his wife, and he was charged and arrested for the count. But the wife did not want to bring charges against him, so this would seem like a good opportunity for Major League Baseball, if they so chose, to step in and say, you know, there is evidence against you. You know, we're going to do something about it, even though there hasn't been any criminal conviction. And then in the end, it ended up being that Phillies and Major League Baseball didn't do anything. They said if his wife really wanted to get involved and wanted to prosecute him, she would have done so at the criminal level, so who are we to come in and step in for that? And he just re-signed this past year with the Phillies for $25 million over 3 years. And then kind of another example that I have is Marion Jones. Just recently admitted to federal prosecutors that she did receive and take steroids from Balco. But we kind of saw with her a deference, and especially after 2000 Olympics, to say, you know, we're not going to hold and pass judgment on her, even though Victor Conti has come out and said that I myself, you know, shot her with the steroids and I myself gave them to her. But we really did hold deference. We didn't want to make a judgment upon her until we had all those facts and were able to, you know, have her come out and say, you know, I did do it. And there really was some support for her, even beyond the Olympics, to say, we're not going to pass judgment on her as a media or as a public when she's you know, very vehement that she did not take steroids, even though she was lying. So, I guess, about the website, that's just like a, gives a kind of tale of where this came from, what it's about. But I guess also talking about the people today and how I've seen that it has
affected. Can we stop you and talk about those cases?
Okay.
I mean, what do you think about the middle case there?
Middle case?
Yeah.
I think that personally, that would have been an opportunity for Major League Baseball to step in and say, you know, we're not held to the same constraints as the judicial system, and if we feel like someone is behaving in a manner that's detrimental to baseball, then we can come in and, you know, suspend you, fine you, or whatever. But Major League Baseball has had a strong commitment that they're only going to attack things that have happened on the criminal level, which is why we've seen a little bit of difference as well from them on the baseball effect. I'll talk about Barry Bonds in a little bit. But I think out of all these three, that one is the most, you know, concrete example of where there is evidence outside of the criminal space that they could have used but didn't, because they didn't want to get too involved in that beyond what the actual criminal charges were.
I mean, I don't know much about it, so I'm just more asking, and to what degree is Major League Baseball hampered by sort of collective bargaining agreements and player association?
Well, under the collective bargaining agreement, the commissioner is allowed to punish players for any conduct that is detrimental to baseball. So under that,
I mean, how much discretion does he have in that? I mean,
complete discretion. But I mean, Bud Selig, David Stern, Paul Tagliabue, now Roger Goodell, have all had complete discretion over players. There is an arbitration process that they can go to, and baseball goes to independent arbitrator, basketball the same, football goes back to the commissioner again. So really, you know, it is independent to kind of appeal those. But the arbitration process is there, but the final decision is from the commissioner. And in arbitration, I don't think a case like Brett Myers would do very well for him.
I guess if I was Major League Baseball, if I was thinking about it, it seems like it would be a lose-lose situation, right? Because say you suspend the guy a game, or you fine him $1 million. Like, how does that? And what symbols in the center? Like, oh, it's only a game. You beat your wife. It's only a game, right? Like, I just seemed like it'd be hard. So how would you go about
it? I think it's more of a symbolic thing, especially for the women's groups involved. It was like that this conduct will not be tolerated for by employers. So I know in the larger scheme of things, maybe they would have liked to have seen him released from the team. And because teams can get out of contracts if a player is convicted of a crime, or if they do things that are detrimental and shine badly upon on the team. So they could have gotten themselves out of the contract. So I think in the larger scale, that would be good. But even just a symbolic thing of fining him a certain amount of money. Like the NFL fined Ray Lewis $250,000. As a symbolic thing that maybe doesn't go exactly with the obstruction of justice charge, but more leans towards the larger scale thing here of he was involved in this this double homicide, basically.
Now, Ray Lewis actually got charged?
He was arrested and charged for a double homicide.
But your second guy has never been charged.
No, he was initially charged, but the charges were dropped because the wife did not want to go along with it.
So how do you go about adjudicating his guilt as your predicate for feeding him to the wolves of the women's groups that are protesting?
Well, the process is that each unit, each league has their own investigative unit where they do their own research on what actually happened. And their standard for what they need in order in terms to say that a person is guilty of whatever they do is much less than the evidence standard that's needed in the criminal case. So they could have made a judgment based upon a much lower standard and saying, you know, you probably are guilty for this. It could be something just probable cause.
Why would they want to do that? Why would they want to have a lousy adjudication in a situation where the wife doesn't want to proceed?
Well,
come to a conclusion that's less good than one that would be made by a full-blown
fight. The larger intent is to protect the brand. So to protect the brand of baseball, to say, you know, we're not a unit of just people who beat their wives. We're going to do this to make sure that people know that we take a firm stance against any type of allegations, even, that that people are beating their wives.
That's how vulnerable the people are that play with us.
Yeah.
Our players are so vulnerable that they can lose their job on an accusation. They don't have to lose their job on anything else.
Exactly.
And we're proud of that. That's what baseball stands for. Well, that's the American way.
I'm saying there is a very clear delineation on how things could be run and how they are run. Like, I'll get some more. I have some examples coming up to where I'll be able to articulate a little bit better the kind of the stance where I see the medium should be. But then, okay.
I was going to say, like, I think this is actually a great example for what you're trying to get across, because in this case, there was good evidence that Brett Myers beat his wife. Like, he most likely did. And that's why baseball stepped in and, like, well, that's why baseball should have stepped in and done something about it. Like, with the Ray Lewis case, I think that's a great example because he did something that hurt the brand of NFL. There was lots of evidence that showed that he probably did have something to do with the double murder. And so football stepped in and said, you know, we're going to fine you to say that you hurt our brand. We want more or less damages from you for hurting our brand. Brett Myers, it would have been a great example there because there was good advice. But, like, on the other hand, if in a case like Brett Myers, his wife accuses him of beating her and it ends up being completely unfounded, she was doing it just to hurt him, and then baseball comes out, they still had their brand damaged by those allegations. But through the arbitration process, they would decide not to fine him. So that would be a great example of the media convicting a guy who wasn't actually guilty, and then baseball being able to deal with it through the arbitration process by not fining him.
Okay, so first, like, I'm going to go through, very good point, but I'm going to go through a couple more examples of different places where the media has stepped in even before there could be a process done by the NFL or done by the NBA or done by the criminal system, has stepped in and said, you know, we're going to convict these people in the media so that, you know, either they lose their livelihood or they lose a lot of sponsors or things like that. So first is Barry Bonds. Most
just,
people
just
in here.
Give me the URL one more time. I still don't know. J. Beachman?
Yeah, it's J-B-E-A-U-C-H.
A, give it to me letter by letter.
J-B-E-A-U-C-H.
U.
Yeah, there's a U in there.
Yeah.
M-A-N.
Yeah.
At googlepages.com. Or no, dot googlepages.com. Not that. I probably should have wrote that. I'll just write on the board real quick.
All right, good.
Okay. All right, so Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds, was actually just, again, recently indicted by the federal courts for obstruction of justice and perjury. But obviously this has been going on for years now, the accusations against Barry Bonds. He was part of a grand jury many years ago where he never at any point during the grand jury said that he admittedly took steroids, but said he took things like the cream and the clear, which he believed to be flaxseed oil and arthritic balm. And but there really has been this huge fervor around Barry Bonds that he did take steroids and he took other things that hasn't really surrounded, like, Marion Jones. We said there was a presumption of innocence with Marion Jones, and we allowed things to play themselves out before we could convict him in our own minds. Whereas with Barry Bonds, we really haven't had that deference. People have been, you know, really on his back from the very beginning, starting in 2000 with the 2002 when the Game of Shadows came out. I mean, and that could be attributed a little bit to the fact that people generally don't like Barry Bonds. He doesn't seem to be the nicest person in the world. But there really hasn't been that kind of deference towards him, and it really has hurt his image in the media. There's basically no national media in terms of marketing endorsements that have surrounded Barry Bonds since basically 2002, and that seems pretty off color with the fact that he's one of the biggest names in baseball. He holds the home run record both in season and for the entire career. So to have that kind of judgment passed upon him before any sort of, I mean, Major League Baseball has done their investigations, has been able to find anything. There's been congressional committees set up that hasn't found anything against them. And right now, we're just now starting to hear some facts about the issue. And it just shows how before we even have any solidified facts, we have our prejudgments against these people, which has definitely hurt Barry Bonds in this case, probably to the matter of 15, maybe more $1 million a year in terms of endorsements that he could have had if he didn't have this windfall behind him.
What's your explanation for the difference between Bonds and Marion Jones?
I don't know. I can't tell you. I mean, obviously he has baseball is a much more in the media sport than track and field is, and he's not the most likable guy in the world, whereas Marion Jones was a very likable person, especially early on in her career. When she was very young, in 2000, I think she was only like maybe 22 or 23, so she was still really young. But I can't explain where the difference comes between those two in terms of judging them and the predisposition we take going into those. Next example that we have is Kobe Bryant, and actually not be 2007. It should be, I believe, 2004. I'll have to change that. In 2004, he was charged with raping a young woman in a Colorado resort. And generally, the NBA took a stance that they were going to allow him to allow the legal proceedings to play themselves out before any decision was made on their part about what's going to happen with Kobe Bryant. Unfortunately, his sponsors didn't take the same deference. They immediately dropped him. I have a couple examples here. McDonald's, Sprite, Nutella, and Ferrero Spas all dropped him immediately upon hearing of these allegations. Kobe Bryant admitted that he committed adultery in this case, but he was very adamant that the sex was consensual, and there was very competing evidence as to what actually happened in the case. But these sponsors, I think they compiled up to about $9 or $10 million a year, all dropped him immediately based upon these accusations. Eventually, the woman dropped the charges against him. It's still unclear whether what actually happened in this instance, but the fact that he was immediately dropped from all these sponsors based upon the public pressure that everyone immediately thought that he was guilty. Now, in Kobe Bryant, it wasn't as adamant as other people may have been, because Kobe Bryant had a very all-American image going into the instance, but it shows how even those people who have the all-American image can be tarnished based upon simply allegations against them. The NBA, which is headed by David Stern, who was a lawyer, I think he went to Columbia, was really adamant about allowing the due process to play itself out. He was going to wait until the criminal proceedings ended before he made any decision. In the end, there was no criminal proceedings, and the NBA ended up not suspending him or fining him at all for the incident. Let's skip Tank Johnson. Go to Pac-Man Jones first.
So I'm interested, though, in what I want to get some thought out of this.
Okay, so the rest of these are just examples, I guess. Pac-Man Jones, never really convicted of anything. Still hasn't been convicted of anything. I think he plea bargained to one count in the Las Vegas shootings recently, but he was suspended for the entire year with no convictions against him by the NFL under the new helm of Roger Goodell, who was not a lawyer. Paul Tagliabue before him was a lawyer, head of the NFL, and it shows that, especially in the NFL now, there is much less emphasis on due process, as can be seen with Tank Johnson as well. Tank Johnson was originally convicted of a guns charge. He had unregistered weapons in his house. And then he was serving a suspension for 8 games, was in good standing besides the suspension, and then was brought in under the thought that he was, I don't know why it's not loading, was brought in under the pretense that he was intoxicated. I think the exact words were, he was driving while impaired to the slightest degree, and was, upon hearing this, the Bears immediately dropped him from the team. They waived him. It actually turned out that he wasn't legally driving drunk. He was under the legal limit. But it shows that this guy no longer had a job just based upon being brought in by the police without any even charges. He was released. He wasn't held overnight. He was released. But as soon as the Bears heard it, they waived him, and there went his job. He eventually re-signed with the Cowboys, I believe 2 weeks ago, and is now on their team after having served the end of his suspension. But it just shows how that the NFL is taking a stance that we're not even going to wait until, in this case, if there's even any charges, as soon as we even hear of anything, we're just going to release you and kind of distance ourselves from you. And then the last one, the most important to me, and probably the most visible one, was Michael Vick this summer, who had his house that he owned but did not live at raided by the police, where they found some dog fighting ring gear, and then eventually evidence was compiled and he was charged with conspiracy. He was eventually charged and then plea bargained to conspiracy to cross state lines to participate in a dog fighting event. So he was never accused of any of the malicious behavior that other people were accused of, or he was never convicted of the malicious behavior that other people were accused of in terms of actually killing dogs or breeding the dogs or fighting the dogs, only to attend one of these events. And so he now faces, I believe, what's predicted to be 12 to 18 months in prison because of this charge, and basically has had his livelihood taken away from him, even before the charges were, before he was indicted and then eventually plea bargained out of those charges, was once the evidence, or once the investigation was started, there was such a fervor made by particularly PETA in terms of pressuring different groups, whether it was All of his endorsers, which included Nike and a bunch of other people too, who I'm kind of forgetting right now, but Nike and other people who immediately dropped Michael Vick. His jersey was removed from stores. His shoes were taken off the shelves. As soon as there was even starting to be an investigation into this, which really he, and then because of the conviction, he basically had his entire life ruined. But even before the conviction happened, so even when it was still in the stage of the investigation, people were pressuring the NFL to release him from the Falcons. People were pressuring the NFL to take a stance against Michael Vick and take a stance on this even before there were any facts adjudicated in the case. And this really, to me, I actually worked for the NFL this summer, so so I saw this firsthand and a lot of this along the way. But this, to me, shows a case where we're, as a society, we're placing too much emphasis on allegations and not enough on allowing our due process and allowing the facts to come out and the evidence in the case, the entire case adjudicate itself before we pass judgment upon these people. And we're causing these people to lose their livelihood. And I understand that some people, that they don't see, you know, professional athlete millionaires as the most sympathetic individuals, where they say, you know, where they say to themselves, I feel bad for these people. But in the end, they're an American citizen just as much as any other person who's here today, who would have a fault if Harvard said they couldn't come to class anymore until you had your case trial, who said that as soon as there's any allegations that you were, you know, doing some illegal behavior, anything they might deem that looks bad for Harvard to release you from the school or something. So I think that.
Hey, okay. Jihan, what's your argument?
So my strategy is kind of, I want to build it with you guys today, is how do we combat this? How do we
combat what? What is it that you don't like?
The prejudgment of people, once the allegations are, there is sort of rumors about it, before the conviction, having there be some sort of period where we don't convict these people in the media before they're actually let the facts be adjudicated. So how
That's what totally confused me about your treatment of the earlier fellow.
Which one?
The guy who slugged his wife.
Brett Myers.
You were ready to hang him.
No, I didn't want to hang Brett Myers. I was saying in Brett Myers that this is a case in the past where the MLB has let the facts play itself out before any judgment was reached. So.
All right, but open up for comments.
So some things that I have thought of that might be helpful in sort of combating this, that we can start from there and then try to build, is one way we could find some sort of forum where people can come and basically show the different types of media that have basically been irresponsible in the reporting of the situation, whether it's convicting players saying, you know, that they're sure they did this, or how we should all be appalled by his behavior, or and having a forum under, like, let's say...
Do you regard the prosecution of Vic to have vindicated the response to him?
I mean, hindsight is very different than going into the matter. So, it vindicated, I mean, so should I have felt, so should someone who wanted to hang Michael Vick as soon as they heard the allegations, should they feel good about themselves, that they were doing it early and I should feel bad because I wanted to wait to pass judgment?
Yeah, I
don't feel that way.
I'm the head of marketing for Nike.
Uh-huh.
And the headlines hit about Vick and dog fights. And I say, whoa, stop. We got to get away from this guy. The worst thing in the world is to be against dogs.
Yeah.
And so pull it instantly.
I mean, there is a difference to me between waiting for the facts to be adjudicated and releasing someone from their contract. So with Kobe Bryant, Nike was the only sponsor who stood by Kobe Bryant through the entire pretrial process. So they said, we're going to wait before we make any decision on the contract. We're going to wait until all the facts are adjudicated. And in the end, when there was no trial, they were able to continue their relationship with Kobe Bryant and really sought, and where other places had dropped them completely, they continued to market with Kobe Bryant. And I think they've seen a sort of loyalty factor with people who stood by Kobe Bryant to purchase Kobe Bryant things. I was actually going to wear my Kobe Bryant shoes today. Now I forgot. But to purchase the Nike things to support him through his tough times, because, like, for me, one of the things I thought of we could have is sort of like an area someone could go to if one of their favorite athletes has been accused of something and they want to stand by that athlete until, you know, the facts are adjudicated. they can go and purchase a pair of Nike shoes that have Kobe Bryant's name on it. The thing with Michael Vick was they pulled him off the shelves. They gave no avenue for anyone who wanted to stand by this player during his tough times. Because, I mean, what happens if this person is innocent? This is a very rough time for them. They have to go through being charges against them that are completely unfounded, and you're not giving a person any avenue to support them in these tough times. So for me,
it's interesting the way it relates back to one of our first classes about prosecutorial abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, certainly for many companies, the fear of an indictment is so overwhelming that if they're threatened with indictment, they'll more or less cough up anything.
Yeah, and I think part of the process, part of this process, it kind of shined a few different aspects as well upon this process, upon like whether it be the targeting of celebrities in prosecutions, and like, and whether that can be justified on an economics basis or a publicity basis in terms of getting it out that dogfighting is wrong and you're going to be prosecuted for it. So just the targeting of Michael Vick for this case is a whole other topic we could discuss for a much longer time.
All right, so get a few people in here and then we've got to wrap up and go on.
That's right.
I just wonder, what do you think of just in terms of, one of the things that bothered me about the whole Michael Vick thing is that I think that if the charges weren't dogfighting, it was he raped someone or beat his wife, but the reaction in the public would have been much less visceral. The NFL would have come down with probably less of a suspension than it did. And I was wondering, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think it's just how much the public pressure is. Like, I mean, in this case, it was PETA. And PETA's like one of the best at, you know, gaining public awareness of issues. So I think in this case, this particular case was probably the height of what it's going to be in terms of people were outside 280 Park Street, where the NFL's headquartered, you know, for an entire week with signs that said, you know, no dogfighters in the NFL, or get rid of Vick, or burning Vick jerseys. So I think that this is definitely the height of what it can be like in terms of he was suspended from the NFL like immediately. Like they didn't give him a chance to, you know, come. Well, he did come in and state his case, but they didn't even give him a chance to let it play through before anything happened. But I think this is the height. I think that if it was a woman's group or whether it was environmental group or something, that would have been less. But then, I mean, that kind of also begs the question, what kind of responsibility does PETA have as a, you know, a very powerful group to, you know, wait until something was adjudicated before they jump on the person for, you know, I would feel bad if PETA came after me for something I didn't do. And so it begs, what kind of responsibility do they have as an institution to the rest of the public?
How does the treatment of professional athletes differ in the media from any other public figure like politicians or entertainers?
I think it's basically the same thing for anyone in the public eye, because it becomes a rallying for a person and the public pressure against them. I mean, for someone who doesn't have the stature of a Michael Vick or of a, I'm forgetting the name of, I think it was Michelle Rodriguez who got arrested for DUI on Lost and was cut from the show based upon that. For someone who doesn't have that kind of, you know, public eye lore, they're not going to have that same sort of pressure on the employer to say, you know, drop this person or fire this person even before the case is finished. And so me, it applies to those cases, the entertainers, the politicians, the sports figures, those people who were in the public eye, and a little bit less to everyone else, though. But I mean, still in some sense, if there may be a local thing where it's in the news where someone's been alleged to have done something, there may be some local cries out there for within small communities saying, you know, we want this person out of town. We don't want them living in our communities anymore. I have a lot of questions. I think your hand was up first.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what do you think about the Duke lacrosse case, like kind of using that as an analogy, and like kind of the backlash against the prosecutorial abuse of that case? Like,
I mean, exactly that. I try to stick with professional athletes in this case, but that was something, I mean, there's plenty of cases with where you have college athletes. There were some at Florida State, there were some at Penn State as well, but Duke is obviously the most visible, where people just completely judged the situation before anything had been adjudicated. It basically ruined these kids' lives. I think one ended up graduating that year, but the other two had to leave the school. They couldn't finish education. The entire Duke lacrosse program, probably the most, you know, the China person was the coach. She was run out of town basically as soon as it happened. So there are definite consequences here when people get accused in the media of doing something, and part of it can be the prosecutorial misconduct, and part of it can just be, you know, the public's desire to convict people before anything's been adjudicated. So I think that's a great example of, in a kind of an indifferent scenario, but an example of where reserving judgment would not ruin basically these kids' lives in those cases.
Can I contextualize this in a slightly different framework?
Tell us who you are.
I'm Scott McLeod. I teach courses in sociology on society and information technology. I teach a course on Berkman Island on Wednesday evenings on society and information technology vis-a-vis Manuel Castells' work. He's a longtime Berkeley professor who's theorized the network society. And in sociology, and this is quite a large view, one key framework, I think, is the question of agency versus structure. And in a nutshell, structure often historically has to do with economic processes, which give rise to certain sort of possibilities in society. And agency has to do with how potentially you conceive of the individual, how choice is affected. So when Professor Nesson was talking earlier, it occurred to me that he was raising questions vis-a-vis agency. You have his choice to smoke marijuana, and then a legal situation, which is a form of structure, in the context of Harvard, which is another kind of structure, that articulate with one another. And the same with RIAA. You have all of end users who are shaping a kind of choice in response to a system. Then you bring in an element where the media plays a role in this structural context to shape representations of sports heroes in the context of capitalism in some ways. And the question I don't hear you asking is how these sports players can exert a form of agency in the context of these very significant and far-reaching structures, namely these corporations and these sports teams. And potentially, they do it in relationship to their legal advocacy. So their representatives begin to become ones who might shape their own agency vis-a-vis these structures. I'm curious how you respond.
Yeah, I mean, the part of the collective bargaining agreement between the NFL Players Association and the NFL allows the commissioner to have full authority over. So I mean, the structure, the players really have very little say in terms of that part of it. That they can't go to the commissioner and say, you know, you have to stand by us in this case and allow us to be able to go along while this, or keep playing while this is going on. In terms of shaping the media in that case of the NFLPA, I mean, I guess it is a good question. There really hasn't been a role, especially recently for Gene Upshaw, who's the head of the NFLPA, in terms of getting out there and standing behind players. One of the cases that I really wish Gene Upshaw had stood behind his players and gotten out into the media was with Tate Johnson, because he was had a prior offense, but in the second offense, there really was no reason to release him so early on. So I think that would have been a definite opportunity for Gene Upshaw to step in and say, hey, we're going to appeal this release and say we're going to step in and find a way to work it so that you're not going to judge our players immediately and allow the court process to play itself out. But in terms of the structure of the NFL stepping in and saying we're going to keep them, there just isn't that side of it in the collective bargaining agreement. It's not that way for the NBA, it's not that way for the MLB. That's the default, as someone may say. And changing that default is, I don't think that's really in the realm of any of the player association right now. But I mean, it is an interesting aspect to see like what the on another side, the NFLPA, what they could do in terms of shaping how people view the players or view particular instances. But that really hasn't been done up to this point. But would be a good question to see, you know, what they could do in order to help it.
Or how players might shape law.
Oh yeah.
So I think you have to wrap up, Gianna.
I know. I think I'm running a little long.
Because we want Sandra and Saeed.
So I guess one thing I really hope you guys help me out with is just what the name of the site should be, because I'm hoping to have it up and running on like a regular .com pretty soon, and then start instituting whether it is an ability for someone to go in and buy products, people who have been accused, or whether it is for someone to be able to say this certain media has been portraying people in a certain way, but giving people a forum to talk about this type of thing. But I don't think mediaconvictions.com is doing it right now. I mean, it's just, it's a little, so I was hoping maybe people had ideas I mean, I don't know if you had to get them right now. You could think about it, get back to me, let me know. I know I'm running out of time anyway, so. But think about it. If you have any ideas, shoot me an email, just talk to me, call me to ideas. But thank you guys for helping me with this presentation. It's something I believe in, so I'm sorry that I got so riled up, but.
Yeah, that's great.
All right, good idea. All right, Xander, how about you?
Sure.
Don't make me look bad.
I don't think that's possible.
You did that yourself, yeah. Don't worry, man.
I'm just kidding. You're just a baby.
You saw me getting passionate about the show, too, so. That's life for you.
I know, man. I'm telling you, Google Pages is the way to go. It took forever. It doesn't look that great, but.
That's good, dude.
Looks good.
Preparation for a career as a consultant. I have a PowerPoint presentation coming up.
Both of those things.
Maybe you need assistance.
Something's clicking oddly. I don't know if that's a good thing. I don't have anything plugged into the speaker. Should I plug this in? Or? It's like doing something funky with the screens. Give me a second. Sorry for the technical difficulties here.
Well, one thought out of jihad's that's interesting to me is how, in some ways, the lawyer's role, at least the traditional lawyer's role, may actually in some way be in conflict with the client's interest in these kinds of media cases. Because so much of the lawyer's culture is to say nothing. And basically take time to put together a defense and then present it in court. But by the time you get to court, a lot can have happened. And so somehow the idea of managing the media situation in advance of trial starts to become part of the lawyer's practice.
That's what it seems like these days. Anyway, this is more of a sort of a skeleton of a project rather than a project itself. I thought that was what we were supposed to do. So in any case, I'll get started. So I spent the previous year or two working on Harvard Undergraduate Council. I served in one of the executive capacities. And very recently we had something of a fight with the administration, as we often do, but this one was over our party fund program, where we basically spend about $1,700 a week giving money to individuals to throw parties. And it's a randomized process. It's a sort of only at Harvard kind of thing. But it was a nice thing. It started in 2003, and it was originally quite welcome at Harvard by the administration. So concerns started to be raised over the years. And in 2007, in October of this year, we were basically ordered to shut down by the dean of the college, David Pilveen. Who's that guy? And that's us. And that's a big X. So we're told to shut down. And then, so he wrote us a letter, which he simultaneously posted online, which basically said, shut down. We refused. The Undergraduate Council just continued funding it, so they cut off access to our term bill fees, without which we couldn't fund student groups, which is sort of the primary function of the student government here. So this didn't last too long. After about a month, the UC basically conceded, giving in to power, and suspended all alcohol funding in accordance with the dean's wishes. And the college restored the funding. So the basic argument from the dean of the college was that primarily the UC was somehow placing the university in this legally liable situation, where because we're reimbursing students without checking their age, oftentimes for alcohol, there's a possibility that we're in fact reimbursing underage students, and that this was a risk to the university. In addition, he said that the party grant program has funded parties where the emphasis is on drinking. I'm not sure exactly what the other sort of party is. And the party grant program has caused some overcrowding problems for the houses, which I think was true.
It's called a cable party.
And so we wrote back a letter, basically, and we try to take on each of these arguments. First of all, we said basically we can't dictate the preference for alcohol. If people want to buy alcohol, they're at liberty to do so. If they want to not buy alcohol, we'll reimburse for non-alcoholic food and beverages as well. Eliminating this program just ends up diminishing social life. It doesn't actually improve choices for anyone. We received no independent confirmation from OGC of any legal liability. In fact, we were rebuffed when we approached them. They told us that we weren't a department or an entity of Harvard, and so we weren't eligible for their counsel. So this whole legal liability.
Wait. You mean you went to the office of
yes.
the general counsel to ask them about your liability?
Yes, whether or not we're imposing any liability on
you. You were doing something that would hurt Harvard.
Yes.
And they said, we don't represent you, so we're not going to tell you.
That's right.
Right.
They considered us a student group. As a student group. Student groups apparently aren't eligible for any counsel from OGC. So our argument was essentially that given the legal uncertainty, we retain sole jurisdiction over the use of our funds as per the original faculty charter. The UC is a creature of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, which is reason for enough, we thought, to get assistance from OGC, but apparently not. And finally, the conclusion was, you know, we'd worked with the deans to negotiate changes for 6 months. We had come up with a series of changes that alleviated the burden on the houses, that alleviated some of the liability issues by sort of centralizing the age checks that the houses were doing anyway. And they were basically instantaneously rejected by the dean. And we felt that violated some spirit of cooperation that we had going. So what I was thinking is that for this project per se, is that really we have two approaches. I'd originally intended to do sort of a mock trial, but as sort of the class progressed, I realized that this is more about argument, about presentation, about getting an argument out and across. And so I was thinking about, you know, if I were to rerun sort of the media campaign, rerun the message, how I would do it. And I was thinking about the audience and the media. And the audience is sort of in an order of accessibility and probably priority. And the media is the same. And so I guess I wanted to solicit some ideas from people in this class as to how, if you're in our position, sort of running this campaign to save our precious party fund system, how you might go about doing it, how you might go about crafting a message and getting it out to all the right audiences. This is sort of a preliminary.
Well, what's your response altering to the concern that you're spending the money on underage alcohol?
Our response was that we are reimbursing individuals for their purchases without regard as to what those purchases are, and without regard also to the age of the purchasers. The requirement for the requirement as far as we're concerned was that, you know, whoever is selling them the alcohol should be checking them for the age. And the fact that we're reimbursing, you know, anyone for alcohol doesn't mean that we're actually selling them alcohol or providing them alcohol in any way. The money could just as well be used to purchase anything else.
And so I'm further in my role as university counsel here. We know that the UC has been passing out money for parties.
Yes.
That regularly turn out to be drinking parties at which underage drinking is taking place.
Sure.
And we're supplying the money for that with knowledge that that's the outcome. Suppose something happens at one of those parties.
Sure.
Like somebody breaks their neck falling out of something, and it turns out that the kid is drunk and 17.
Sure.
What argument do we have in response to an accusation that mm-hmm. we've been negligent?
Well, first of all, you as the university isn't providing the money for the alcohol. It's an optional term bill fee that comes from the students that goes directly to the UC. Unfortunately, it has to be handled by the university, and I suppose that makes it the university's funds for a moment. But at least in theory, it was never really the university's money. As to your second point, you know, there is a question of liability. But the houses already have checks to make sure that the hosts of parties are over 21 if they serve alcohol. And the proposal that we had made to the Office of the Dean was to integrate that process with our process so that the UC would only reimburse alcohol for parties that had been essentially whitelisted by the houses. The legal issue with that, of course, is that the houses themselves don't do a legally proper check, because the data in the student directory is self-reported. It's not good from the perspective of the law. And so really the concern was not so much, in our view, that the UC wasn't doing enough to prevent a risk to the university, but rather that the houses weren't, and that they were trying to pass on the liability to us.
Open up.
Just a question about how
sure.
the funding works.
Is it
just an optional to just go to the UC, or is it specifically for the party fund?
It goes straight to the UC. There's
okay.
There's no provision just for the party fund.
So what else does the UC do with the funds?
The vast majority of the funds goes to the house committees, which operate for house life, and then to student groups through a grant system. Yes.
If you're on the other side of this conversation,
yeah.
you're from the university side point,
yeah.
and let's say this program hadn't been operating for 3 or 4 years
mm-hmm.
and this was being proposed,
yeah.
as an administrator, would it seem like a good idea to you?
Well, they thought it was a good idea in 2003.
What about you?
We also had outside counsel in 2003 review it, and they thought it was a sufficient degree of separation. You know, of course, like anything involving alcohol, anything involving money for parties is always risky business as far as the university is concerned. But the university has a mission, and we think this is in accordance with it, and it's worth the risk.
I mean, I guess, like, from my perspective, when I look at this, like, the first thing my torts professor told me
mm-hmm.
is he was teaching our class, and he was talking about suing people.
Yeah.
And he said, when you sue somebody, want to get as many people as you can.
Yeah.
So if you got hit by a car, and that car was driven by a drunk driver, that car's a Toyota, you're going to want to see the driver, you're going to want to see the bar he drank at, you're going to want to see the local shop that sold him the car, you're going to sue Toyota for making a car that's somehow unsafe to operate under the alcohol. You're going to want to sue everyone.
Sure.
So if you're looking at it from an administrator standpoint, now that the program's been operating for 3 years,
yeah.
and you now have pretty good proof or pretty good evidence that it's being used to alcohol. I mean, doesn't this seem like something that's just not worth letting the kids have their way on? I mean, what's the advantage to the university?
Well, okay, that's a fair question. As I view it, the advantage to the university is to promote a healthy and, in fact, safe social environment. When parties are not centralized, or rather, when you don't have house parties that are sustainable because people are paying them to throw them, you have underground parties that aren't being registered, where there is no check on age, and you have parties that are happening at places like vinyl clubs. And none of these places are regulated in any way. And with the current system, with the party fund system, all the parties have to be registered. They're registered with the houses, so they're under the supervision of the house system and the tutors. And so they're actually safer. They're not less safe than the alternative. As to your question about liability, yeah, like any of this could potentially create some sort of liability down the line. And there is a risk to that. And at some point, I think you take the expected value of all that liability, and you say, you know, what is that against, you know, what this does for student life on an annual basis, what that does for returns from alumni, from returns to the university. And whichever, you know, comes out ahead is what you take. Yeah.
I just kind of want to kind of ask Andrew a question. With the hypothetical you gave before, where the guy suing everybody who had any peripheral involvement, like the fact that it happens on Harvard's campus, wouldn't that kind of already pull them into the liability umbrella?
Absolutely.
And,
which is
and the fact that they have outside counsel.
I mean, as outside counsel, if anything, you tell, I mean, if I'm working in the GC's office and they say, what do you think about this? I would say, not only do you not fund, give them $100 to do it, but you start cracking down on these parties as much as you can. If you've got a house where they know they're serving alcohol, and he's just admitted that they self-report their ages, whatever, then I would say you've got to revamp your age thing to make sure that it's in accordance with the law, because otherwise eventually you're going to get sued for a bunch of money. And if you decide that it's worth it to you to fight that legal battle when it comes up, because it's worth it to you to have these other soft factors in terms of social involvement and a healthy community, then that's a decision you have to make. But the legal reality is, the first time something happens, and I only know this because this happened at UCLA when I was there. They used to have this big fraternity party called Black Sunday, which was the Sunday before Rush. It was fraternity parties. I mean, everyone knows what happens at fraternity parties. And a police officer went in to break one up and got pushed, like just completely accidentally got pushed, fell, tripped over a balcony, and broke her back. Now there's no more Black Sunday. She's suing both the police force and the university system, the University of California system, because they have an interfraternity council that they fund. And it was basically, her point was, it's when you guys were fully aware that fraternity parties get out of hand, and you can't just say like, oh, that's the IFC, they're not a part of the university. You were giving them money, and anyone with any sense knows what fraternities do with money, and therefore you were like blatantly contributing to the negligence, and you didn't do anything about it until I broke my back. So I would say, as a general counsel, if anyone asked me, my opinion would be on this, that like, okay, look, maybe you won't do this, but the legal reality is, as soon as someone gets hurt, Harvard is gonna get hammered. They're gonna get hammered in the media, because every press release is gonna be Harvard-funded party, student ODs and dies at Harvard-funded party. And then you're gonna have a lawsuit from the parents who are gonna be like, are you telling me you were giving them $100? Like, and all 100 of those dollars my son drank? Like, I mean, it's just gonna be a disaster. So, I mean, if you're gonna like try and move something like this, I mean, my question is, how do you address that issue? How do you address that issue in a more compelling way, rather than just saying, we like our parties and it's better for us to have parties that you know about than to have parties that you don't know about? Because from a GC's perspective, it's much better for us if we have parties that we don't know about. I mean, it might be unhealthy, or like physically unhealthier for you, but from a liability perspective, it's healthier for us. So, I mean, I would just say like,
yeah, I mean, again, like, it just strikes me that...
Let's get some others in before we get too far along. Ryan?
So why don't you put a couple of months' worth of this thing's budget into buying the little barcode or whatever scanners that they use to check IDs?
Because we didn't want to check IDs.
Did you want underage drinking?
No, I mean, we don't want the UC to become a police force to, like, goes around checking people's IDs. We just don't think that's our role.
Okay.
I mean, that's why we try to centralize it with the houses, but the houses didn't want that liability either. Yeah.
Why don't you just give them money and be like, it absolutely cannot be selling alcohol, make them sign like a form saying that you won't spend it, check
yeah.
their receipts, make sure it's not, I mean, you can have a party and if you buy everything else, I mean, gin doesn't cost that much. I mean, you can still buy it.
Yeah, I mean,
and then there
right.
would be a problem.
I mean, that's where we are now. The reality is that we've seen a huge drop-off in applications. And, you know, shocker. And the question, I mean, the program is, in my view, not if it doesn't fund alcohol.
Well,
I mean, it's the
I
vast majority of the party's
expenses.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go to mom. Well, I guess you can't buy liquor at grocery stores here.
What's the historical precedent here? Well, I suspect this issue has come up and been batted down for 150 years. And some of the most interesting cases might be in the 60s and 70s. How does the potential for underage drinking continue to open at Harvard?
What do you mean?
I mean, so it's. I suspect that Willie's liability issues played out numerous times.
Probably.
And yet, now it's, or until recent, you know, it's been possible again and again potentially for folks who are underage to start drinking again here. How does that work?
How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, what are those processes that it becomes less controlled? I'm suspecting it's been controlled in the past.
I don't know. I mean, I think the history of Harvard as an institution has been largely the history of whoever's in charge, that is like the top administrators. The program was initiated under Larry Summers' term when Larry Summers was on a crusade to improve the undergraduate experience. And so at that point, the risk was worth it. Now it's not. And you know, simultaneously with this campaign to sort of shut down this program has been a campaign from Harvard up at the various highest levels to crack down on individual student groups that supply alcohol. So right now, the college has instituted a new policy that holds individual student leaders personally responsible for any alcohol-related incidents that may go on at their parties. Now, what personally responsible means is completely unclear, but at the very least, it means disciplinary action from the administrative board.
So here's it's another fascinating example in this way of the relationship of the university to the law.
Yeah.
And you're seeing in the enforcement of the alcohol laws a structuring of the university environment to require conformance to it, that the university is becoming the alcohol police.
Sure, it is.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, university, at least in my experience, was always given a little latitude as a place for kids to grow up, you know, where, yes, there was a rule, but yes, you also understood that there was no disaster in a kid having a beer. And yes, there were sometimes abuses of that, but in many ways, learning how to deal with abuse is what growing up is all about.
Sure.
So I am struck by the overlap with this and with the RIAA issue and with any number of others, I suppose we could point to.
Isn't the difference though that in this case, there seems to me to be something fundamentally different between the university providing internet access that has clear use and everything else and just providing as a service and not regulating what the kids do with it versus providing money that what I've heard is being directly used for alcohol, and when they attempt to put the lowest levels of things like saying like you can use it to fund a party and we're going to turn a blind eye to what you do with anything that's not directly our money, but just our cash has to go to food, and they're like, look, we don't want it. Like when like it seems to me like a direct cash infusion for what you knowledgeably know is an illegal activity is slightly different than providing an avenue that kids can use to do something that may or may not be illegal and falls under different, you know, an obscure regulatory guidelines.
So let's just suppose that I teach this class, right? And I think, well, let's have a concluding party. And so I buy the beer, and I don't ID check people in the class. And lo and behold, it turns out that Xander is underage. Is this something that I should be strung up for? You know, a faculty member? Suppose I knew he was underage. Am I to say, oh, Xander, you can't have a beer? I mean, it's so extraordinary in some sense that build the law into the code of the university, so there's no flex whatsoever. And you imagine a world of perfect enforcement. Do we want to live in a world of perfect enforcement? I bet you, if you think about it, you think not. You think that the flex in the law is what makes it livable. Certainly one of the issues in a code world is the threat of perfect enforcement. Zittrain writes about this beautifully in the book he's just coming out. But then you imagine, all right, you can't have perfect enforcement, but is the goal to structure university process so as to come as close as possible? No faculty member can give a party for his students at which alcohol is served. It's not the university I want to be. And I frankly would like to have a general counsel's office that fought for me and fought for the environment that I think a university should preserve. The idea that the general counsel is some kind of money hack who's out there making a liability argument because some plaintiff's lawyer follows the tactics that Andrew suggests and just sues anybody, and therefore we have to calculate the cost of resisting that, and since that's more than this or that, I mean, what sort of bullshit is it? Who is their client? What do they think the university interest is? It's not just the pocketbook. We actually stand for something. So how can you get that across?
Well, that's the question. I think it's even more than that. It's who do you get the question across to? And one thing that I found in sort of, you know, the month or so of resistance was that the people who were actually most keen to listen to us, but was not the students at all, but individual faculty members who were concerned, and members of the faculty council who were concerned about the faculty's relationship with the administrators, because the UC is set up by faculty charter, and the legislation is very specific about what it can or can't do with relationship to, you know, X and Y deans. And they were concerned that the deans could erode on faculty privilege, on faculty legislation in that way. And so we were really surprised to find that response.
In other words, a procedural response that
yeah,
has to do with power.
It has to do with power.
Relations and nothing to do with alcohol.
No, nothing at all. I mean, they didn't care about the alcohol issue. They cared about the faculty's relationship with the people who manage the budgets. And so that was something we found pretty interesting. So we found that our best source, our best ally in this was actually not, you know, any of the super deans, but in fact the faculty council, which is sort of this 18-member governing board of the faculty. So I would really want to figure out who to make my pitch to and what pitch it would be. And I think the university argument is one that's best made to members of the faculty, perhaps, but I think it's really the power argument that needs to be made to those who have the power to deal with this. And that's how I would have done it if I could do it over. That's something we discovered only at the end.
Very interesting. Yeah.
It seems to me that you're going to have to address what you have to figure out and address what your main argument is or if you want to address the issue that you think that students should be allowed to be adults when they're 18 and grow up, and like some of these experiences are going to be necessary, and it might be necessary for the university to provide an environment where those experiences can occur, then I think that your project has to somehow communicate that. Your project the argument that this has been happening and so therefore we should, and like, you know, we kind of think we just should get it because we want it.
It just seems to me that we can either ignore the legal argument nor dismiss it. Like, it's just there, and it has to sort of be like addressed in a way that says like we can. It's enough that we can put it on the side, But like, we can't win on the legal issue. Like, none of us are lawyers.
I agree.
None of us in the UC.
A lawyer would probably tell you that the law, letter of the law pretty clearly spells out what you can do. But I mean, you have to engage the university's concerns about that. I mean, you have to engage it in a way that that allows the university to understand that you appreciate their concerns, but
sure.
That there's a higher point here, not just.
Right.
I agree with that. And so, it's like the main question here is essentially how are you going to appeal the university in a way that allows them to condone the illegal activity and actually support the illegal activity.
A questionable activity. Activity of questionable legality. Yes.
I guess what is a sort of student opinion? I mean, obviously, it's probably unpopular for the college to go ahead and ban, you know, these UC arguments. But it seemed like the UC was a pretty, at least when I was there, was a pretty small element of this, like, funding for social life. Right? So much of that is organic. And so,
sure.
If the question is really, like, I mean, the point about the, you know, university setting being a place where our students should be able to,
mm-hmm.
you know, explore, like, that's still going to happen regardless of whether the UC provides $100 to parties, right? So, like,
I'm not sure about that. I think that, I don't know what it was like when you went there, but virtually every party that I go to that's sort of public, at least, is funded by the UC, either because it's a student group party that's funded or because it's an individual party that's funded. I think that changes as you get older, but the prevalence, I think, is still there.
Well, I guess it seems to me it's going to be hard to make the sell that, you know, like the college should have to provide money for students to drink. Because
sure.
At the end of the day, students can drink when they want to drink. I mean, like, if you want alcohol, you can get it somehow.
Sure.
So, like, that exploration is still going to happen. So, like, I just feel like getting, when you talk about the media and presenting this to the public, I feel like I think it's pretty unique that Harvard actually, like, does things like Stein Club and pays for students' alcohol. Like, that's not a common thing. And so, like, I don't know how much sympathy you get in, like, elsewhere about, you know, okay,
I
never went.
No, I agree with you. I mean, in fact, when we sort of did some polling with students and try to make arguments to the students, the issue that they had was more that the deans would sort of do this, like, unilaterally and sort of this quick strike response rather than the act itself. I mean, that was, is more the question of university as writ large than it was the party fund program. Yeah.
All right, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you next week. Saeed, we're going to have to postpone.
Sorry.